The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week is actually a double portion, a portion of Tazria and Metzora. Interesting question. How to be sensitive to where we are and when to tune in, when to tune out, and the value of the two. Tell you an interesting story, which maybe some of you have heard before. And we get opportunities to appreciate this sort of again and again. I was down in Florida for Pesach. And it's funny how a little detail, and I'm still thinking about this, that you actually know but kind of forget can make all the difference. And how difficult it is to try to be sensitive and to be in the moment and still sensitive to everybody else's moments at the same time. Before Pesach, we were on our way to America, and we decided we wanted to give the kids a little bit of a broader horizon. So we managed to stop in Amsterdam. And I've never been to Amsterdam, and the kids are old enough now that they can finally start to appreciate this. And among the other things that we did, we went to Anne Frank's house, which maybe some of you have been to, which is an extremely powerful experience, or at least it was for me, and really gives you the opportunity to appreciate the things that you take for granted, the little things. And just to see this space, to see how they had to hide, and to try to imagine, you know, a girl who's not even a teenager yet, or just entering that stage, to be cramped up in such a small space for 2 years, and the struggles that they had, and just walking around the old Jewish quarter of Amsterdam, around the corner, not far from Anne Frank's house, is a theater, which was originally just a regular theater. When the Nazis came to Amsterdam, they changed it to being the Jewish theater, and one of the early edicts that they passed in Amsterdam was that no non-Jews, no Aryans could go to this theater, and only Jews could perform there because they wanted to separate the Jewish population from everybody else. And it became the Jewish theater. And ultimately, it became the scene of the greatest Jewish tragedy, because that was the place where Jews who were deported in the Actions that took them to Westerbork and from there to Auschwitz, Treblinka and Sobibor, where they were gathered. And it was very hard to find this place. We heard about it from someone at the Jewish Museum. And we had to walk around looking for it. And eventually you come across it, and there's an exhibit of photos, which is not the tourist exhibit. In fact, it was only in Dutch, so I didn't know it was written there, but you could figure it out. And it was such a powerful experience. Not just to be standing in a place where what happened there happened. And not even just that we were standing in a place where hundreds and hundreds of Jews at a time were made to stand out in the freezing cold and in the boiling sun in this open courtyard, and the pictures of what they went through and the knowledge of where they were going. But, you know, I've been to Poland, and I stood in Auschwitz and in Majdanek. What really made this particularly powerful for me was that I was standing there with my family. And that's a whole different mindset. And I couldn't get it off my mind. And we got to Israel, and we got to America, and I was doing some Pesach programs. It was the Eve of the Seder, and I was talking with a few people, you know, and there's a particular couple who are actually parents of someone on this phone call, and I knew that he was a Holocaust survivor, and I had actually forgotten that he was from Amsterdam. And what I really forgot was that that the night of the Seder is a particularly powerful evening for him, because it was the night that his family was taken away, and it was really sort of one of the last experiences that he had in a normal setting with his family before everything went upside down. And we got into this very deep discussion. And I was thinking about this afterwards. How do you stay in your moment and be cognizant of the moments that other people are experiencing? How easy is it to see something and to have a perspective and not appreciate that someone else sharing the same exact experience is in a completely different place? I remember we were, this was in 2000, so some of you know that I got called up pretty much overnight when all hell broke loose on Rosh Hashanah, what they're calling now the Second Intifada. Of course, that implies that the first one ended, and that's a whole political discussion. But we got drafted overnight in what's called a Tzav Shmona, which is basically an emergency draft order. I had personally never experienced that before. I hope I never experience it again. Up until that experience, whenever I was in the Army, I knew that I was going to be in the Army. It was an expectation. I had time to prepare for it. This is the first time where there was no warning. We didn't know how long we were going in for. We didn't know when we were getting out. I remember my battalion commander called me, the middle of the night after Rosh Hashanah and said, look, we're being called up. You got to get your gear together. And I said to him, well, when do I have to be there? And he said, well, how soon can you pack your stuff? And I said to him, well, how long do you think we're going to be there for? And he said, I have no idea. And we ended up for 6 weeks stuck in the Army. And you can imagine that everything turned topsy-turvy. And that whole month and a half was just incident after incident. I mean, it's hard to describe. But I remember one particular afternoon, I was in my, Jeep. I was on a roving command post. And I get a call that there's a Jew who has wandered into the village of Vadinis, which is an Arab village near Efrat. And he's walking around there with a gun, and there's a huge crowd of Arabs surrounding him. And those of you who remember the stories of, like, the lynchings in Ramallah, you can understand that we were very sensitive to these types of things. So I tore off in my Jeep. I get to the edge of Efrat. There's a sort of a guard post, and sure enough, I see a guy. He's got a kippah on. He's talking to a bunch of Arabs. There are a bunch of Arabs that are gesticulating, and there must have been, I don't know, 200, maybe 300 Arabs surrounding him. So this is going from bad to worse. So there was nothing really else I could do, and I was wondering what on earth a Jew was doing wandering in there. But we had no choice. We didn't have time to wait for backup. So basically the three of us in a Jeep, we tore off into this village. And, with everything going on and shootings and everything else, you can imagine that I was pretty nervous. And I actually, when I got close, realized that I knew exactly who this fellow was. He was the security officer for Efrat, whose name I won't repeat. But I couldn't imagine what on earth he was doing. He wasn't, he wasn't in the Army. He was a civilian whose job during normal times was to be responsible for the security in Efrat. But now, even though he commands a high position in Efrat on security, because the Army had taken over the area, so now he was sort of under my command, right? And that was a little, I think, challenging for him. So, I got in there, wanted to know what he was doing there, and I said, listen, we're leaving, and he wanted to talk to a few of the Arabs. I said, this is just not the time to do it. Anyway, we got him out of there, and everybody calmed down, and I had to talk to the mukhtar, to the head of the village. It was a whole discussion. Turned out, what was he doing there? The Arabs, we were basically struggling because there are 2 or 3 small villages, and they're on the edge of Efrat, but we're only about on the northern tip of Efrat, about 10 or 15 minutes from Beit Lechem, from Bethlehem, where there were some very large terrorist cells, and the Palestinian Authority controls it, and a lot of serious issues with terrorism, and still are. And we were trying to figure out ways to protect, the northern approach to Efrat. And one of the things that we realized was, given that we had a fairly close relationship with these Arab villages that are next to Efrat, Vadinis in particular, Abdal Ibrahim, so one of the things that we realized was that it would be a very easy thing for terrorists to sneak into these villages, to shoot at Efrat from these villages, to create the impression that we had to retaliate against these villages, and of course that could lead in all sorts of unhealthy directions. So the Moitza of Efrat, the Council of Efrat, decided that they would fund, along with the army, putting up street lamps along the road that led from Beit Lechem into this Arab village. Because they figured if there was more light, it would be easier to spot someone if he was moving, and it would be easier to, respond to any threats that might come from there. Well, the Arabs saw a bulldozer and a whole bunch of equipment coming up and driving up near their village, and they thought that, the army is appropriating land, and they all went nuts. So this security officer who had a close relationship with the Arabs in the village, he decided to go in there to calm them down. So after we pulled him out of there, I took him aside, and I let him have it. I mean, I really reamed him. What on earth are you doing? I mean, he had endangered not only me, and not only my men, and not to mention himself. And this just wasn't the time to be walking into an Arab village alone with a gun, even if we had previously shared a good relationship, and by the way, still do with these particular villagers. But his response completely changed my perspective on the situation. You see, you think I went in there because I care so much about those villagers? He said, the reason I went in there was because I care so much about us, about what this is doing to us. Right? When we wake up in the morning and all this has calmed down, I'm not worried about what we'll have done to the Arabs, because that'll be their fault. I'm worried about everything, what we do to the Arabs may do to us. It's not Arab bodies that I'm worried about, it's Jewish souls. And that the real question, he was saying, is how we protect who we are, right? How do you protect your soul? How do you make sure when you hear about and see Jewish soldiers offering water to Arab terrorists or cleaning up their homes after being forced to use them as lookout posts, what they're doing is not just about the Arab property, it's about their Jewish soul. How do you do that? Is there a message? Is there a vehicle? So hidden in between the lines of this week's portion of Metzorah is a very powerful message about how what we do affects who we are. This week, as well as last week, in the portion of Tazria and Metzorah, or I should say now there are 2 weeks, right? Two portions this week, really deals with, by and large, something called Tzarat. Now, Tzarat is loosely defined as leprosy in English translations, but it's not really leprosy. I'll spare you the differences. But let's assume for the moment that it's a form of malady that seems to resemble leprosy, a skin disease, whatever it might be. However, the Jewish perception, and certainly the biblical perception of this disease, is that this is not a disease that occurs for medical reasons, but rather this is something that occurs for spiritual reasons. And this particular, what's called a nega or an affliction, this affliction can afflict your home, it can afflict your clothing, and it can even afflict your body. And what's fascinating is that although the Torah does support the idea of doctors, in this particular instance, if a person suffers this particular malady, he goes not to a doctor, but to a priest, to a kohen. And the rabbis suggest that the reason for this, Rashi talks about this, Maimonides talks about this, is because this particular affliction comes for the mistake or the transgression of Lashon Hara, of slandering your fellow human being, right? And Maimonides even goes so far as to suggest that that in his laws of Tumat Tzarat, that once it's clear that a person in fact is suffering from Tzarat, he is suffering because he's made the mistake of speaking slander. And in fact, he has to leave not only his home and his family, but the camp of Israel as well. And only after the prescribed period of time can he begin the process of re-entering society, right? V'nikat asher, the person who is becoming pure has to wash his clothes, he has to shave his hair, he has to wash in water and become pure. And the only then may he come back into the camp and sit outside his tent for another 7 days, right? In other words, even after an extensive period of purification, the Metzorah, the person who's afflicted, is still excluded from his home, from his family, even from his community, and left outside his tent to continue his process of purification. Now that's a very interesting question. Because given that the malady in question is clearly viewed by Jewish tradition as the physical consequence of a spiritual mistake, slandering your fellow human being, so you have to wonder why the process of mending the error in his ways necessitates being shunned by society and excluded from even physically being a part of the community. I mean, wouldn't it be more productive, wouldn't it make more sense to include such a person in the community in order to teach him the value of a positive relationship with those around him? Right? Wouldn't we be better off showering him with love rather than punishing him with banishment? Right? Even the wicked son still joins us at the Pesach Seder. So why is this fellow, guilty of slander, banished from the camp? Some of you may remember that we once discussed a similar question. If the reason that we are exiles from Israel is because we have somehow slipped from the spiritual level that we're meant to be on, wouldn't it make more sense to keep us in Israel, where supposedly we can achieve a higher spiritual level? What's the purpose of exile? What's the purpose of banishment? Right? And Maimonides, who suggests that the penalty of the Metzorah of the leper, or I should say, the afflicted with Tzarat, because it's not exactly leprosy, is so severe precisely because of the error in his ways, which we are attempting to correct. Since his sin is so destructive to the fabric of society, let him sit alone and contemplate what he has done. If his tongue, in slandering his fellow human beings, says the Talmud in Erechin, was used for such negative purposes, it's better for a while for him to have no one to talk to. Since he causes husbands to separate from wives and friends to become separate from each other, let him now experience the same and be separated from anyone. And while that's true, it still seems at first glance that this punishment is somewhat counterproductive to what this process is hoping to achieve. How do we teach a person the value of oneness when all we do is to separate him from everybody else. So the truth is that a closer look at this issue reveals that all is not quite as it seems. If indeed the problem with slander or with Lashon Hara is that it causes people to think ill of each other and it distances the listener from those that he is hearing slander about, right, causing rifts in society and undermining the goal of a people and in fact a world where we all learn to live as one, then we would have a hard time explaining a case of someone speaking slander being punished even when such a consequence to his actions could not possibly exist, right? And I'll give you a good example, right? The best example of this is the case of none other than Moshe himself. Moshe, Moses, at the, if you remember, has his first encounter with God at the burning bush. And in the middle of this whole experience, in Perek Dalet Pasuk Vav, right, chapter 4, verse 6, Moshe is actually made to experience the pain and the challenge of this same affliction of tzarat, of what people mistakenly translate as leprosy. And Rashi there suggests that this comes, as a, and the Midrash talks about this, that this comes as a punishment for his slander of the Jewish people. Right? Moshe suggests that these people are not on a certain level, v'hein lo yaminu li, they won't believe me, they don't have faith, right? They've sunken into the idolatrous ways of Egypt, and God basically lets him have it. Who are you to slander my people? In declaring that the Jewish people would not believe that he was indeed sent by God, Moshe is both questioning the Jewish people's integrity, as well as slandering them in describing them as a people that would not believe the messenger of God. And for this, suggests Rashi, Moshe is fittingly punished with a degree of tzarat, right, with this type of leprosy, which, as mentioned, is the consequence of slander. But then you start to realize, well, wait a second, what transgression has actually occurred? I mean, it's ludicrous to assume that hearing the slander of Moshe somehow impacts God's perception of the Jewish people. And it's equally absurd to imagine that such slander can cause God to somehow distance himself from the Jewish people. And the case of Moshe isn't unique, by the way. We find this occurs with Eliyahu Navi, Elijah the prophet, in the book of Kings, Yishayahu, who are both punished for their harsh criticism of the Jewish people, even though they are speaking to no one else but God. Very difficult question. So maybe the transgression of slander is so severe, not only for its impact on society, but as well, and perhaps even foremost, for its impact on the speaker himself. If a person can speak negatively about his or her fellow human being, then he or she doesn't really see the image of God that's part of every human being, and that has to gradually destroy your soul. Right? If I speak ill of another human being, I'm not just damaging them, I'm actually damaging myself as well. Now, this is interesting. You know, if you really stop to think about this, right, I'll give you an example. One of the questions that we've sometimes spoken about and that people sometimes ask, how could a person who calls him or herself religious, whatever the word religious means, right? Let's define it as a stereotypical definition, even though we sort of, upon closer examination, realize that that's ridiculous. But let's assume for the moment that you see a fellow with a kippah, a yarmulke, a skull cap on his head. He wears tefillin in the morning. Maybe he wears a long black coat. He only eats kosher food. So you assume this person's religious. He's struggling to develop a relationship with his Jewish identity, whatever it might be. So if a person like that acts like a pig, if a person like that is unethical, so that really challenges us. Because how can a person who believes in God treat his fellow human being unethically? But the truth is, the definition is mistaken. Because if a person treats his fellow human being unethically, then in that moment, he actually doesn't believe in God. He's distant from God. Because if you really knew that Hashem, that God existed, if you really understood that God is in the world and that God is everywhere, you could not treat another human being unethically. Because you would recognize that that fellow human being is created by God. You would see the image of God in that human being, and you could never treat them unethically. When I behave unethically to another human being, I'm really behaving as though there's no God. By the way, conversely, the same is true. If you declare yourself an atheist, if such a thing could exist, and you believe that God does not exist, and yet you treat your fellow human being ethically, it may well be that that's because deep down you instinctively understand that every human being is created in the image of God. And in that behavior, you are stating and demonstrating, whether consciously or subconsciously, that God actually does exist. Because if God didn't exist, and people weren't created, and they were just random, there really wouldn't be a reason to treat your fellow human being ethically. Right? And to go against animal instincts that say that, you know, I am the most important organism in the world. Which leads us, by the way, to a crucial idea that Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl points out in his Sichot LeSefer VaYikra, in his comments on this parsha, in terms of the relationship between where we are spiritually and where we are physically. And Yom Kippur is an example. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, he doesn't just walk straight into the Holy of Holies in the temple. He first has to undergo a very extensive process, which prepares him for that moment. And it's interesting that he undergoes almost the same process as the Metzora, as the leper, but in the opposite direction. Whereas the leper who has slandered his fellow human being, I shouldn't say leper because it's not leprosy, we'll call him a Metzora, okay? The Metzora, right, as a result of the slander that he commits against his fellow human being, has to leave his home. He not only has to leave his home, he has to leave the entire camp of Israel, right? There are concentric circles that form the Jewish people. There is the Holy of Holies, and that's surrounded by the rest of the temple, and that's surrounded by the camp of the priests, and then the Levites, and then the Israelites. The Metzora, even if he's a priest, has to step all the way outside and go outside the Israelite camp. And whereas the Kohen Gadol leaves his home and goes up onto the Temple Mount and lives in the temple for 7 days prior to Yom Kippur, the Metzora takes the opposite direction and goes out of the camp of Israel. Right? And apparently, part of the process which elevates the Kohen spiritually is that he lives in a place of sanctity. And where he is living is actually a part of who he's trying to become. Conversely, the Metzora is forced out of even the Jewish camp, which is considered less sanctified than the temple area or the camp of the priests or the Levites, precisely because his soul is on a lower level. Right? When you speak slander against another human being, you damage your soul. And the desolation that you cause others is first and foremost the desolation that affects yourself. So the Metzora has to spend some time in a place of desolation as befitting the spiritual state of his own soul. And that, by the way, incidentally, is why when the Jewish people, through their misdeeds, reach a particularly low spiritual level, they are no longer worthy of living as a people in the land of Israel and are ultimately forced into exile. Right? And even today, when we're in the midst of the incredible process of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, we're still far from being worthy of a holy, united city with the Beit HaMikdash, a home of sanctity on the Temple Mount. In fact, you could go so far as to suggest, you know, just as an example, the fact that today there are 10 times as many Arabs living in the Old City as there are Jews. And this despite the fact that we have a modern state of Israel. It's not because the Arabs are doing something wrong. It's rather because we are. We are, it seems, not yet worthy of truly being home. And sometimes we become so immersed in our mistakes that we don't even appreciate how much work we have to do. We assume we're in great shape because, after all, we're doing so many wonderful things. We hopefully give a lot of tzedakah. We celebrate Shabbat. Some of us are into kosher food, but some of us are into ethical food. We only have to look around and see where we are to realize to some extent who we are. It's therefore not an accident that the Chafetz Chaim believed that the single transgression which was most preventing us from the final redemption and the return home to the land of Israel and to peace on earth is not because Jews don't celebrate Shabbat. It's not because Jews aren't eating kosher food. It's because of the monumental tragedy of slander, of Lashon Hara. Right? In fact, tradition tells us that this was, in fact, do you know what the first exile was? The first exile that occurs to Jews is the exile of the brothers, right? Who begin with Joseph, who is sold down to Egypt, and eventually the brothers follow, and eventually the Jewish people end up in Egypt. Right? And that mistake begins with slander. It begins because Vayavidi Batam Ra'a, Joseph actually slanders his brothers. Right? Do you ever wonder what could happen that would force Joseph to undergo such tragedy? He must have done something wrong. He slanders his brothers. And he is forced to leave his home and his community and to reflect upon this. And without the time to go into it, you actually see in the process of his rehabilitation how he fixes this. Do you know what the second exile of the Jewish people is? The second exile of the Jewish people, interestingly enough, is not where we are forced to leave the land of Israel. The second exile of the Jewish people is when we almost get to go to Israel and we lose the opportunity. How do we lose the opportunity to go to the land of Israel? Right? Because the spies speak slander, and they don't even speak slander about people. They speak slander against the land of Israel. They talk about how it's an Eretz Ochelet Yoshvea, it consumes its inhabitants, and without going into the details. Right? In other words, the terrible mistake of the spies who spoke ill of the land of Israel, and maybe perhaps in assuming that they couldn't conquer the land, even with God's help, of the Jewish people as well, right? this mistake leads to the consequence of their error, which was exile, 40 years in the desert, on a par with the desolation that this transgression brought in their hearts and souls. And this is why the Torah, by the way, commands us not only not to do bad things, but not to think them as well. For example, Maimonides suggests, and we're almost done, Maimonides suggests that the most difficult commandment to fulfill in the Torah, right? Do you know what the most difficult commandment is? It's lo tisna et achicha b'levavecha. Don't hate, don't bear any enmity or grudge against your fellow human being in your heart. You can do the right thing, you can smile in public, but if inside your heart and soul you detest someone, you are actually violating a biblical commandment. Unbelievable. You can put tefillin on till you're blue in the face. You can eat all the kosher food in the world. If you hate someone, you are transgressing a biblical commandment every day you wake up in the morning. It's amazing. And what's so terrible about that? Suppose you never speak ill against that person. Suppose you never do anything about it. Suppose no one ever knows but you. The only transgression that I can imagine is what you've done to yourself. You've prevented yourself from being the person that you could be. Right? So of course that leaves us with one final question. Right? If the problem of slander is that it destroys my perception of the godliness in others, right, and therefore a person needs to separate himself from society and be alone because he needs time to do some serious thinking or quite literally some soul searching, then the question is, well, how do you accomplish this? If in fact the lower spiritual level a person is on demands that he be sent to the wilderness, how does he get back home? What will actually cause the tzarat to leave him and to allow his body and soul to become pure again? So without going too much into the details, this is simply the balance between the value of a good deed and the destruction caused by a bad deed. In fact, Jewish tradition believes they are not equal. The good and the value that a positive action can accrue is far, far, far beyond what a bad deed does. In other words, if you thought that to undo every mistake you've made, you needed an equally valuable good deed, that would be depressing. But in fact, Judaism gives us a break. God gives us a break, depending on how you look at it. The Tosefta goes so far as to point out that the value of a good deed is 500 times as much as the destruction caused by a bad deed. And even if you choose not to take this literally, and I'm not sure it's literal, the rabbis are clearly pointing out that the value of goodness is not simply parallel to the negative consequences of evil. So if that's true, when you consider how serious a negative thought is, right, consider then the implications of one positive thought. Right? Imagine what it must do to your soul to actually think well of another human being, or to praise a community or its rabbi, rather than to denigrate it. You know, it's an amazing thing how, you know, sometimes I'll meet people who are struggling and their kids are having issues and they feel like they don't have a teacher, they don't have a rabbi, they don't have the right rabbi. And when you really get down to it, how many lunchtime conversations and dinner thoughts and sometimes even conversations in front of the children, how many times do we take our teachers and our rabbis and our leaders apart piece by piece before we finally have completely stripped our children of any role models they could have had? You know, I remember when sitting Shabbat lunch at a table, right, and a family was talking about something that that the rabbi and shul had been talking about, and this was a big cause for debate. It was a controversial issue, and they were ripping this rabbi to shreds, right? And when they were all done ripping him to shreds, and of course the children all sitting there listening to this, right? So then finally, they want to know why one of the sons didn't stay in for the sermon, right? We don't even begin to understand the value. But imagine if you do the opposite. Imagine if we find opportunities to create beauty in the world, to give praise, and to have positive thoughts. Now, it's true you won't get as many listeners if you're speaking positively about someone, or even about everyone, because we love to hear the dirt. But by speaking positively, we succeed in cleaning up the dirt in our souls. Right? And by the way, that's possibly the essence of the Seder night, when we spend an entire evening praising not only God, but also the entire Jewish people. Right? The mitzvah of this night is v'higadata, to tell over, to speak. Right? And that's what we just went through over the whole period of Pesach. And the solution to the challenge of avoiding the temptation to speak ill of each other is simply to speak words of praise all night long, right? Which, of course, is how we get to the climax of the entire process, which is when we sing L'shana Haba B'Yerushalayim, the chance to finally come home to Israel and Jerusalem. Because where we are affects who we are, even if we can't always see it. And if we want to become the nation we are meant to be, so maybe finally it's time to go home. You know, maybe this year will finally be the year. And maybe we'll succeed in all the positive aspects of all that we have to offer and all that we have to give and all that we have to share in changing the way we view the world and in changing the way the world sees us. And, you know, the ultimate response to the leper is that he in fact does re-enter society and begins to change everything.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.